All right, and now we're ready to go ahead and get started. Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org, and we are very glad you could join us today. We've got a nice crowd today. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your moderator. We will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. And excuse me one second, I'm getting a little feedback. All right, and if you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on your participants panel, and either Ava Jean or Lori will try to assist you via the chat panel, or you can select their name in a little drop-down send to menu in the chat panel and ask them for assistance. Once you have been helped, please do lower your hand. Now, today's topic is the recently published Threat and Hazard Identification and Risk Assessment, or FIRA, Guide CPG 201. This is one of the major components for implementing Presidential Policy Directive 8, also known as PPD 8, that we featured during this past January. And you can find that program in our archives. There are several related links posted on today's background page, and you can check those out later. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A. Am I having an audio issue? One moment. All right. No, I guess we're all right. But we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. We also ask you not to send private messages to the speaker or moderator, as we will have our hands full. We are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, along with the copy of today's slides. And we continue to make those available in the manner we have in the past. And a text transcript will be posted early next week. And if you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our home page, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome back Donald Doc Lumpkins, and he established the Program Executive Office charged with coordinating the implementation of PPD 8 on national preparedness and currently serves as its executive director. He also serves as branch chief for National Planning Coordination and Assistance, the National Preparedness Directorate at FEMA. Welcome back, Doc. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for everybody who's joined in on the call. I see some questions have cropped up already, so we'll keep an eye on those. We'll see how many of those I answer during the briefing, and then you can certainly ping me afterwards. To tell me what I forgot to do. I will also apologize that this one's a little bit denser than my usual presentations. What we're going to do today is talk through the FIRA process. Now, as Ava Jean, as was mentioned, I am with the PPD Program Office, so we are not a grants office. So we're the ones charged on the programmatic side with implementing the directive. So you'll forgive me in advance if I tap dance on grants-related questions. On the other hand, if you need help writing a plan or conducting some sort of bizarre field operation, then I'm your guy. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about FIRA, Threat and Hazard Identification Risk Assessment, and Risk Assessment. And let's see if I am smart enough to do this. There we go. So you'll see up on the slide now, for background on PPD 8, where the FIRA fits in is that it is part of the National Preparedness System. So it's the tools and processes we use, which include risk assessment and planning and training, exercise, assessments, all those things, in order to build, sustain, and deliver capability. So the FIRA is one of the early pieces of that effort. Focusing on how we take, in particular, existing efforts in risk assessment, whether that's the things you do for critical infrastructure or hazard mitigation or you name it, and bring them together using a common process that helps us ultimately get to a set of capability targets, or the things that we want to achieve. So, as I mentioned, this is part of the National Preparedness System. There are a number of components of which, and we are focusing on identifying and assessing risk. So, first things first, talk through the basic elements or steps of the CIRA writ large, then we'll go piece by piece in this. So as you can see on this slide, it is a relatively straightforward process. The way that we, when we talk to people about this, obviously conducting risk assessments can be very complex. But this particular process that we've been developing, working with some colleagues across not only the federal family, but also state and local government, is to take a fairly straightforward effort to identify the threats and hazards that are of concern. Based on data and information you already have, give context to those, perhaps winnow down that list a little bit to something manageable, and then use it as a way to examine the core capabilities so you can begin identifying not only the targets for those capabilities, but also understand and provide so you can sort out both the impacts and the outcomes on those capabilities and ultimately set the targets there in step four. The CIRA guide does not really get into application. So we decided to focus first on getting people to the point where they had a set of targets, where they had a set of information, and use that to set the stage for other activities, whether that's an effort to analyze and estimate your capabilities, what you have, what you need, whether that's fed into the hazard mitigation planning, benefit cost analysis activities, that sort of thing, whether it feeds into strategic planning. We left that to the discretion of the user. This is really focused on that front end. What you'll see on the chart in front of you is that as we built this in mind to the fact that there's already a reporting requirement out there on states in particular dealing with the state preparedness report. And so we want to make sure that whatever we were doing would feed into that. And so we think we've been able to strike that balance. So let's have some fun. Let's talk through each of these steps. I've mentioned the core capabilities a couple times. This is just to refresh your recollection. They are listed in the National Preparedness Goal. There are 31 unique core capabilities, but certainly they replicate in a number of mission areas. Taken together, they represent the combined efforts of the whole community to actually address various threats and hazards. So CIRA process, let's go step by step through this. This is the process itself. In order to support the process, we wanted to make sure that you had a number of tools at your disposal. So beyond the guide, there is a toolkit that is out there that provides a bibliography which has a list of data sources in there that you can draw from. The templates that you would use in order to collect information, whether that's for the description statements, if you will, the things that provide context, desired outcomes you might have, the estimated impacts of those capabilities, and ultimately the core capability targets. So not just guidance sort of dumped out there, but also providing some of the tools that you need to actually complete the effort. So I mentioned in that bibliography, it's got strategy sources, policy sources. It also contains where you can get data on different threats and hazards to make sure that you have reasonable access to that information. Now, one thing to be aware of here, you know, when we talk about data sources throughout this, this process is designed to be as simple or as complex as you would like. You know, somebody pushed me on it, and I saw Carver and some others on here, folks that I've worked with over the years. You know, when I was with the state of Maryland, you know, we could take a very simple approach and put this information together in an afternoon. We had a good hazard mitigation plan. We had a rep program. We had an understanding with our fusion center and our joint terrorism task force. And we could go through many of these front-end steps fairly quickly. Or we could have called in scientists and researchers and conducted surveys and everything else and really done an expanded process. These sources are here to help you make this as accessible as you wish, so you can focus on the primary effort, which is defining those targets. So, FIRA, step by step. Number one, identifying threats and hazards of concern to you. What does this mean? Well, first, there are three types of threats or hazards when we talk about them. Natural, so things that just happened through Mother Nature. Hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, fires, disease outbreaks, all the wonderful things that come with living here on planet Earth. Again, no particular trigger by a person, no adversary involved, anything like that. Second is technological. So think of dam failures, hazardous material spills, nuclear power plant issues, that sort of thing, are often technological hazards. So they are the result of man's activities, but again, there's no bad guy. On the other hand, things that might be considered threats or are human-caused definitely involve the intentional actions of an adversary. Now, often people go to different terrorism events, which is certainly true. Large-scale civil disturbance involves an adversary. Even school violence involves an adversary. And so it's a fairly broad spectrum of things that involve intentional actors, and perhaps more importantly, actors that can react to our planning, our preparedness efforts, and adjust. So a slightly more complicated list. On the next slide, you'll see some examples. This is not an exhaustive list. One of the things that we get pinged on when people see this box, whether it's in CPG 101, the planning guidance, whether it's in 201 of the FIRA, whether it's in the National Preparedness Document, is why isn't X on the list? Why isn't Y on the list? This is not an exhaustive list, and it is not a restrictive list. This is simply a set of examples. And so when you take a look at this, you can get a sense of, you know, the scope of things that you might consider when you're identifying potential threats and hazards. I suspect many of you could sit down and come up with just a list of threats and hazards right now. But if you needed to dig, you can look at existing assessments, previous incidents. Look at your plans. Historically, what have you planned for? And what have jurisdictions around you planned for? Remember, risk just doesn't exist within your borders. Some of the risks you face exist outside of your jurisdiction, but you would be impacted should an event occur. You know, we see this a lot with industrial areas. We see this a lot with power generating facilities and even major sporting venues that draw from a region or across an entire state. That impact might be more than just the borders of the county or the city or even the state where the event occurred. And then there's all sorts of online data sources. We know that there are private data sources out there. We are the federal government, and we have to be careful about endorsing anything. So you'll see that our lists point to publicly accessible lists or sources that are available to you. Some other sources, hazard mitigation plans. My favorite, my go-to, start right there. A lot of work and research has been done. After action reports from previous incidents can help you also gather information about that. And then all your subject matter experts, the people you work with day in and day out. So in this step, all you are doing is making a list. So we have to worry about tornadoes and earthquakes. We don't have to worry about hurricanes. We have to worry about flooding, but we don't have to worry about, you know, we really don't have a big issue with a chemical event in our jurisdiction, like a chemical plant. We're worried about, you know, bombings. We're less worried about a nuclear device. You know, so you're not even really prioritizing. You're just deciding, if I'm going to make a list of the 10, 15 things that I'm concerned about, what would that list be? As you do that, there comes a point, though, where just making the list isn't enough. We now have to give that list of threats and hazards context. It's the so what. So when we talk about context, you want to take that original list of threats and hazards and begin to refine and reduce it to those of greatest concern. And I'll give you an example of a minute. But in my case, I often say the worst, most probable. So you can consult your hazard mitigation plan. You can look at SME reviews, analysis, policy directives, historical data, risk maps, all those things that help bubble that list. There's no prescribed number. We're not going to tell you that you're going to have at least 5 or at least 10 or whatever. What you want is a comprehensive list of threats and hazards that is reflective of your concerns and you think will adequately stress the full suite of the core capabilities, the 31 capabilities that you need to consider when you build. So as you're winnowing that down and you're focusing on that, you want to be able to explain how a threat or hazard can affect your jurisdiction. So if your jurisdiction has a nuclear power plant, you may want to consider the implications of having an incident during the day versus during the night. If you're worried about terrorism, you might want to consider different target types, hard or soft, government versus areas of public gathering, etc. That statement that you want to begin to build should provide context for a scenario that is the greatest concern. So if you think about hazard mitigation planning, and I go to that because that's where we have a lot of history, you know, things that help define context, you know, location, where the risk might occur, a specific hazard might occur, the extent of it, prior occurrences, and sometimes, you know, the expected frequency, as well as impact or expected damages. So another way to consider this, as you think about it, and as you look through the threats and hazards, is what about them keeps you up at night? So a couple of examples to provide context to the context discussion. If I am in a state and I'm worried about hurricanes, it's not enough to say that I'm worried about a hurricane. The reality is that based on the worst, most probable, so not the absolute doomsday scenario, because we want you to be able to build capability that can deal with those worst, most probable things and be manageable at the end of the day. So if I think about my hurricane threat, most of the times when I'm facing hurricanes, I'm facing a one or a two, category one or category two hurricane. Category five has never happened. It's not to say it couldn't, but it's never happened in my jurisdiction. So based on my experience and projections and weather patterns and all those fun things, for my hurricane statement, my context, my description statement might very well be a high-end category three hurricane making landfall during the height of tourism season in a beachfront community. Right? So that helps narrow down what it is exactly you're worried about when it comes to a hurricane. If you're thinking about, you know, terrorism and you worry about improvised explosives, you may look at that and say, I'm not just worried about IEDs. What I'm really worried about is a bombing attack against a stadium during the height of college football season against a rival team. You know, I went to Georgia Tech, so I know which game I'm thinking of, and I'll give you my opinion about the Bulldogs later. But each of you can think of those types of scenarios, and you want to take those statements and put those down on paper. And that'll give you a sense. And you might need to do, you know, you might want to look at more than a handful, or you might want to look at the same threat two or three different ways, or you might want to look at how it can cascade. But what you're doing is that you're taking those threats and hazards and giving them context. So first you're making a list of the things that you're worried about, and then by giving them context, you begin winnowing down that list. And you will, you know, you will probably end up in an area where you've got half a dozen, maybe more, of these statements in order to stress different capabilities across your jurisdiction. So now that you've gotten to this point, the next step in the process is actually examining those core capabilities. This is where we find that people probably have the most challenges in understanding the process, because we're asking you to take some things that you would normally sort of mix together and break them into distinct processes. And two, we're actually asking you now to think about numbers. And I don't know if you're like me, but I always get a little nervous when I start putting numbers down on paper. But from a planning standpoint, as a planner, I know that I have to have some rough order of magnitude in order to understand the kind of equipment I need, training, personnel, et cetera. Step three is what helps get us into that arena. So step three, examining the core capabilities using threats and hazards. This is when you'll begin making decisions about how those threats and hazards will actually impact the community through the lens of the core capabilities. You'll begin to set goals with desired outcomes, focusing on the accomplishment of the capabilities, but doing so in a way that uses the scenario that's plausible and credible, and considering what's relevant and urgent. Some of these scenarios and threats that you'll be using are day-to-day incidents that are large that could happen. Some of them would be very infrequent events that might stress the core capabilities of a state or region or even the nation. So, this is broken up into two parts. First, identifying desired outcomes, and then second, identifying impacts. So first, desired outcomes. What do we mean by that? I want you to think of the desired outcome as, what is it that, how would you define success? So, for example, here at FEMA, when it comes to our response capabilities, our desired outcome is to stabilize an event within the first 72 hours. If you think of it, that's a big shift. Before, a lot of people were thinking first boots on the ground in 72 hours. But as part of our policy here, we want to begin reorienting our efforts, so that we have put the resources in place to stabilize in 72 hours. 72 hours might not be the number that you pick. This is something that you decide, and you may not even like that outcome. You might pick something different. The intent here is that you want to begin this discussion about your capabilities with the end in mind. What does success look like? You know, I want to be able to scan, 25% of cargo, or maybe I want to be able to scan 100% of the people entering a special event. You know, what are these big things, these big outcomes that you want to be able to achieve at the end of the day? On the next slide, you'll see some examples of those for a couple of the different capabilities. Again, these are examples. We're happy to work with jurisdictions to get through this process. But these are some ideas, some things that we've thought about. And you can see, whether that's on prevention, protection, mitigation, response, and recovery. We gave you an example from each one. Where possible, these should be quantitatively measurable, but sometimes they can't be. Sometimes it's a qualitative analysis. And sometimes it's seeking a change. For example, if you look at the long-term vulnerability reduction, we want to be able to achieve a decrease. It's not a 100% thing or 72-hour thing. It's, in this case, a measurable decrease in long-term vulnerability. That's what our outcome is that we're after for that particular capability. So if you would use the Reese's Cup approach to this discussion, that's sort of the chocolate half, the desired outcomes. The estimated impact then becomes the peanut butter. And yes, you can all yell at me later for using a candy reference. And I probably owe them money now. So for estimated impacts, you want to think about what a threat or hazard means to a particular capability. This is where some of that research, the work you've done in hazard mitigation planning already, these other things, will begin to become really handy, because you don't want to recreate the wheel if you don't have to. And there may be modeling that we've done that can assist you, or modeling that you can do that can assist you in this effort. So first things first, not every core capability is going to apply to every threat or hazard. You're going to have some that you would just put, you know what, not applicable. You know, we're not doing a whole lot of screening, search, and detection for bad guys under the prevention mission when it comes to hurricanes. I'm going to guess. Not a lot, but, you know, an argument can be made that under really big hurricanes, maybe there are some activities there that we'd be working on. So that's one piece. In some cases, because you're dealing with prevention and protection as well, we talk about impact. I don't mean impact to be something that's genuine, that's just response-driven. We want to think about some of the actions you would take. So it is that impact on the capability, not impact in the notion of post-event, what are we doing? So some estimated impacts could be displaced households, could be intelligence requirements, could be disruption in infrastructure. This is one of those times where you really want to be able to bring all your partners to the table, and certainly at different levels of government, to be able to get the ideas of what some of these impacts look like. So I can talk about it a lot, or I can show you. So let's put up the table. Here's an example of estimated impacts for three different types of threats and hazards, a human-caused, a technological, and a natural. And as you can see, we looked at these capabilities in a couple different mission areas. So whether it's screening, search, and detection and prevention, access control and identity verification and protection, and then, of course, mitigation, response, recovery as well. Notice these have no context to them yet. These are purely the impacts. So like I said, this is the peanut butter side of the equation. We project a certain number of fatalities, a certain number of casualties. Now, one of the questions we've already started getting from people is, what if my numbers are wrong? Well, this is an estimate, you know, estimated impacts. And there are data sources that can help you understand and address what these numbers might be. But the reality is that they are estimated numbers. So they may be a little high, they may be a little low. I always err on the side of caution. I'm not suggesting, however, that people inflate their numbers. But if you're not sure, there's a lot of data sources out there that could help you. You would be surprised. And, of course, our folks in the FEMA regions, our federal preparedness coordinators and their staff, can help you get access to those resources, whether that's getting you in contact with another agency, whether that's getting you access to data. We want to keep this thing operating in that unclassified world, but there are plenty of sources out there that have helped you estimate what these impacts might be for different capabilities. And so I'd encourage you, if your jurisdiction to work with, if your local jurisdiction to work with your state government, I would also encourage working with the states, working with their federal partners, bringing those to bear to assist the local jurisdiction, what have you. But there are a stunning amount of sources out there available to help you get your arms around these estimates. What's in front of you is one way to display this. The end result, as long as there's a matrix that somehow helps you understand what these estimates might be and their impacts, I think that you'll be in a good place. And as you can certainly see, some of the threats and hazards here affect a lot of capabilities. There are some that have no bearing on, let's say, prevention or protection capabilities. You know, a cyber scenario will be slightly different in what it affects. So, that's a lot. But again, let's sort of reset real quick. In step one, you're making that list: earthquakes, tornadoes, bombings, etc. Step two, you're giving those threats and hazards context. In other words, what is it about that threat or hazard that worries you, that would keep you up at night? Now, where might it occur, how big it might be, something like that. And then in step three, you're identifying desired outcomes, what success looks like, and what the impacts are on those threats and hazards, of those threats and hazards that you've identified, on your capabilities. In step four, we bring it all together. So, setting capability targets. Since you've identified the greatest impact of a threat or hazard, and what and the impacts on capability, on the capabilities that result from those threats and hazards, and you identified overall definitions of success, your desired outcomes, you can combine this information to get a capability target. In determining, now when we're focusing on this process, our primary focus is on greatest impact. The goal here is to get you to a place where you understand the kind of capability that you need that would be viable for any threat or hazard. So the goal is to not simply understand it just by a single threat or hazard, but rather looking across that matrix you're building, what are those greatest impacts? So in determining the greatest impact, you would look at the tables and determine what most stress your capabilities. There could be impacts from multiple hazards that need to be considered. It doesn't need to be limited to one hazard. So, for example, for public warning, you might have three different targets, one dealing with a notice event like a hurricane, one dealing with a limited notice event like a tornado, and one dealing with a no notice event like a terrorist attack. Or an earthquake or something like that, or a dam failure. They all might be the greatest impact for different reasons. So you have the option to define more than one target for public information and warning. You may, however, just choose one. This is also the opportunity to revisit your desired outcomes. So you may look at your final impacts and go, you know what, we said we wanted to be able to stabilize an event in 72 hours, but revisiting these numbers, maybe it really needs to be 96, you know, or maybe we can even reduce it down to 48, who knows. But this is a chance to revisit that desired outcome. The other thing is that impacts, if percentages, should be translated to actual numbers if possible. You may not be able to do that. Your number of critical infrastructure might be fuzzy, so you might have to say 25% of critical infrastructure instead of saying 126 or something like that. Again, for some of the more complex capabilities, you may want multiple targets. You may also want a target depending on the mission. So, one last thing to keep in mind, and then we'll throw up some examples so you get a sense of what it is I'm talking to. Not every core capability is going to be applicable in the same way at each level of government. So, there might be capabilities that you would not necessarily build or not build to any significance at a city or county level that the state might be taking on. And there might be certain capabilities, in particular in forensics attribution, that the federal government may have most of the capability for that, and the state may not build a lot of capability in one particular area or another. So these are some things that should come by engaging the whole community, by including your partners in the process, to understand how those pieces come together. So what do targets look like? There are a couple examples up on the slide in front of you. Some of these are, some of them tend to be a little bit of a federal bias, but they are examples. So, you know, that desired outcome for screening, search, and detection was screen 100% of targeted cargo conveyances, mail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Based on the threats and hazards in the community that we looked at earlier, and I'll help you out here for a second. So let's go back real quick. You'll see here, screening, search, and detection. A lone actor deploys an improvised explosive device, in an indoor concourse of a stadium during a sporting event. 67,000 spectators are involved in that. You know that this is the desired outcome, screen 100%. So the 67,500 was the highest impact for that particular capability. So you bring the two together, right? Screen 67,500 people associated with an imminent terrorist threat or an act using technical, non-technical, intrusive, or non-intrusive means. That seems like a high number. But if you have NFL football, or honestly, especially college football, in your jurisdiction, you know that that number might actually be on the low side, depending on the size of the stadium. So don't be overwhelmed by some of the numbers. That's the projections for that jurisdiction. But you can see now that based on that target, I can use that in a number of different ways going forward. Access and control. Remember in that stadium example, there are 25,000 vendors. So they use that was their high number to look at access control for the stadium, or access control is the capability target. For long-term vulnerability reduction, it was the technological hazard that drove them to the high mark, and that's one target they've identified. And so on down the line. You can see that this one here for fatality management, during the first 72 hours of an incident, conduct operations to recover 375 fatalities. So I think you can begin to get the picture of what a target looks like. Obviously, somebody can jump straight to the end of the process and lay this stuff out. We're asking you to go through the process because we think it's a good thinking and analytical exercise to understand what your greatest concerns are and, more importantly, to engage beyond your own office. I mean, I won't kid you. If I got this task when I was in state government, I probably would have sat down, worked through it with a couple people in the office first, and then used that to go out and talk to other people. You can do that. But I think it has greater value if you engage beyond your office early on in step one and do this exercise together and work through those targets. So this is the end game for the cyber process, to lead you to a point where you have identified your threats and hazards, you've provided them context, you've set desired outcomes for your jurisdiction, and bringing all that information together, you're able to understand the impact of those threats and hazards and develop a set of capability targets. This is the same thing that we'll be expected to do here, and which we've already begun, and you can see that in the National Preparedness Goal. And it'll be the same thing, ultimately, that is occurring in our FEMA regions as well, as they'll work across all the states and work with federal partners to develop these. This process is the same process that we'll be using as well. Once you get to those targets, there's a lot of things you could do with them. And that's the last step, applying the results. So you can use those targets as part of assessment or reporting requirements, for example, the state preparedness report. You can find that you see these targets and you look at them and go, you know what? We can actually switch to a sustainment mode on some of our capabilities. We've peaked at where we need to be, and that allows us to then focus funding, personnel, other additional resources in areas where we have gaps or shortfalls. So it becomes a budgeting tool. You can use it for hazard mitigation planning. We continue to refine with our colleagues in mitigation how this information can shape and inform hazard mitigation plans. So there's a number of different ways that this information can ultimately be leveraged for you going forward. It can also help inform other assessments. So again, I mentioned as an example that our FEMA regions will be conducting their own risk assessments, and we have a requirement to conduct a strategic national risk assessment. We've done one already. We'll have to do an update at some point here in the future. And being able to work with you using a common process, but recognizing that your threats and hazards and what you're concerned about may not be the concerns of your neighbor, may not be the concerns of a multi-state region, may not even be the concerns of an entire nation, but that does not make them less important. So by using a common process, we're able to talk to each other in the same way, we're able to understand where we are in the process, we're able to share information, but provide each level of government the flexibility it needs to address its threats and hazards and its capability targets. So going forward to some wrap-up thoughts, and then we have time for questions. Like I said, I noticed that there were some in already. Where are we at with the cyber process? The guide and the toolkit are out there. And we are in the process now, we started this week, of conducting a training, a full one-day training, well, a little bit more than one day, with representatives from states around the country. It is very much an abbreviated training, but it goes through all of this stuff and provides the opportunity for some practical exercises. So the slides I'm using today are actually from that course, but without the practical, without the, okay, let's stop and let all of you 10 minutes do something. We are also having our training folks along with us on that delivery so they can develop an independent study course to support this. We will make technical assistance available through the FEMA regions to jurisdictions around the country for those who need a little bit more help going through the process once they've gone through the initial training. And, of course, we're here to answer questions, take emails, et cetera, so that people understand how the process works or are searching for a data source or need a point of contact. So there's a lot of mechanisms to help you work through this process. I'll speak briefly on the grant programs, and I know one of our folks is online and will shoot me an email if I screw this up. Yes, there is certainly a requirement for grantees in the FY12 grant program to complete the THIRA by December 31st. That is for grantees. There is not a federal requirement on sub-grantees, but obviously as each grantee in particular states choose to implement the THIRA, the expectation is that they're working with their local jurisdictions to participate in that process. So how they choose to do that, we would defer to them on. In some cases, that means bringing you in. In some cases, they'll probably ask you to go through this process as well. The intent here is that, again, you can make this as simple or as complex as you wish. You could work with your trusted partners, the experiences that you've had, the plans that you have in place, your mitigation planning you've already conducted, and go through this process fairly straightforward, fairly easily. Or you could start looking at complex probabilistic information. You could look at conducting massive modeling, all those things to also help drive this effort. That flexibility is in your hands. The reason that through this process we're asking you to identify targets is that over the years, in talking and listening to folks, talking with and listening to folks, we learned that it didn't make sense for the federal government to set those targets, that you understood your threats and hazards the best, that you understood what you faced, and that the power to set the targets ought to lie in your hands. So part of the outcome of this process is to provide the tools necessary to do that in a manner that's consistent across the country. So that's it for my 45-minute stump speech on the THIRA process. Again, this is a set of slides that often we would use over the course of 7 or 8 hours, along with some practical exercises to help you understand this. So take this as an introduction to the topic. And recognize that there is the opportunities coming up not only for technical assistance, but also independent study. So with that, Amy and Eva Jean, I will hand back over to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Doc, and I hope folks will have a better general idea of the process now. We've already got a few questions in here, but let me review the process that we use. The most important thing, folks, is put your question in the Q&A panel, not in the chat panel. Then you just type it underneath, and please select host, and then you type it underneath, you hit send. I am going to announce, pretty much we'll take the questions in order. Doc, I am going to announce who it's from. I'm going to read it to you, and then we will go through as many of them as we can get to. We may not be able to get to all of them. Okay, so the first one I have on the line here is from John Biddy, and he asks, implementation of PPD8 is a DHS and EMA function. Have the two departments developed an actual data collection tool to conduct the THIRA, or will localities develop their own tool based on the sample given in the guide?
Okay. So first things first, despite sometimes our public behavior, we're actually one happy department. The issue, I think, gets to the crux of the matter of the connectivity between what's considered traditional prevention and protection and response recovery mitigation. So the short answer is yes. This process is designed to account for all of that, and the toolkit that was issued with 201 contains those tools that you can use to capture the information for each step of the process.
Okay. And possibly the grantees or the states may also have some further guidance for you when we get there, right?
Yep.
Okay, we have Patty Reuter who asks, are there national standards for certain core capabilities that you can identify, and how do you verify the numbers? Where are the data sources you are talking about? And again, we refer you to that bibliography. That's some of them, correct?
Correct. So some of them are, there are data sources contained in that toolkit that will help folks get to a standard source. Obviously, if you're working with a threat or hazard, the hazard mitigation plan, certainly for natural, in some cases, in some states, they've really covered, done a really fantastic job of covering technological and human cause to a great extent as well. Can serve as sources for those data points, and that's identified in the toolkit as well. In terms of the national standards piece, sure. Some of that's identified in the bibliography. Our ultimate goal to take standards to the nth degree is we want to be able to apply the resource typing model that we use for a number of response-related capabilities and ultimately see how we can apply that model or structure to all 31 of the core capabilities. That's a longer-term goal. We're certainly not there yet. PPD8 effort is only just a little over a year old, and the core capabilities list younger than that. But that is our ultimate goal. But where standards exist, you know, if there's for a particular capability that you have a concern about, you can certainly email us. And I know our email address was up on my last slide, so maybe we can throw that up before the call is over.
Matter of fact, I'll put that up.
Okay.
I can do that right now.
There we go. Email us. And I realize now that there is the email address is backwards. We switched the email system, so I'll apologize for that. It's actually, let me see how well our technology works here today. Let's try this. It's at FEMA.DHS.
I may have to make you presenter again. One moment.
All right, so now I'm the presenter.
Okay, right now. There we go.
And do you see that at FEMA.DHS.gov?
Yes.
Okay, so we will use that as it's as the end instead of DHS.FEMA.gov, and we'll collect that in the final slide before it's posted. But shoot us an email there, and we can help you identify a particular standard.
All right, very good. Okay, Chris Snyder from PEMA, he says, is FIRA intended to be a process or a product or both?
It is a process that leads to a product. That product being your target, your capability targets. That's the short answer. Sorry, I have nothing more complex than that.
Yeah, that's okay.
And real quick, just to revisit an answer I gave to an earlier question, the toolkit is up and available electronically, and I will confirm, if not, we will make it happen, that the spreadsheets that go with that toolkit are also posted as spreadsheets. Somebody was asking about the electronic versions of the forms, so we'll make sure those are up.
Okay, yeah, we do have links on background page, but did not see any spreadsheets yet, so I'll update that when we get that.
Okay.
All righty. Here's one from Jason Baldwin. Maybe you can see it as I put it in. When should we apply the content of DHS's MGT-310/315? Do you know what document he's referring to there, Doc?
I will try to remember which management document it is.
Okay. Versus FEMA's Hazard Mitigation Risk Assessment Guidance, versus CPG 201? Is the requirement based on which mission area the data is being applied to? When they are called FIRA is quite confusing. And one of the things I also wanted to ask you about was whether, you know, you could kind of address the relationship between the FIRA and the mitigation framework.
Sure. So Management 310-315, which I believe is the risk assessment course, and also gets to the risk management fundamentals, and the hazard mitigation guidance are not mutually exclusive to the FIRA. Now, the course itself will be updated to reflect the FIRA pieces, but there's nothing in here that is inherent contradiction. It's rather just a process of application. Same thing with the hazard mitigation plan guidance. The intent here is that when you complete the FIRA, you can take that information and actually feed it into the hazard mitigation planning process, because now you have a robust set of information, not just that includes information related to terrorism, which has honestly been a gap in some of the hazard mitigation planning. So that's the thought process behind this. You'll see some of that in the messaging from our deputy administrator, Mr. Manning, that is out on FIRA. And you'll actually see some messaging soon, joint messaging coming from Mr. Manning and Mr. Dave Miller, who heads up the Federal Insurance and Mitigation Administration here at FEMA, to talk about in greater detail the connectivity between the FIRA efforts and overall mitigation planning.
I've got a similar kind of question from Rick Skinner, who asks, he says, FIRA seems to duplicate in concept the HVA, that's that hazard vulnerability assessment or whatever, for example, that hospitals have using for a number of years. How are FIRA and HVA similar and different? Do you envision FIRA replacing HVA? So the question really goes to the hospital, the medical services community and so on.
Sure. So HVA, and which is one methodology, and methodology similar to it, are really effective when you're talking about a constrained system. So that could be a single facility. It could be something like a transit system, things like that, where you have a defined area where you have specific targets, or let me phrase that, specific points of attack or points of exposure to hazards, that sort of thing. What FIRA does is that it does borrow from those processes, but it's applied in a way that allows us to look at a geopolitical environment. So what we found is if you took some of the traditional models that were used for critical infrastructure key resources and tried to simply overlay them on a full-size county or a city or a township or a state, that they didn't work right. They weren't designed for that sort of diffuse environment. And so we took some of the lessons learned from those processes and used that to help shape the FIRA. But the FIRA is designed more for that geopolitical construct. Now, the theory here, of course, is that you are still doing HVA or looking at your critical infrastructure or things like that. Another perfect example is MISRAM, which is the tool used for ports that a number of you participate in. And that information can help feed into the FIRA process. So when you look in the toolkit and in the guide and we talk about data sources, in a number of places we talk about using these existing efforts to feed into as data sources into this process, and vice versa, that the results of the FIRA may feed into other assessments. Ultimately, we would obviously like to reduce the number of assessments, but one of the lessons I've certainly learned over the last 8 years having joined the federal government is that it's kind of like trying to reduce the number of screwdrivers you have. It gets to a point where there are just different kinds of jobs that have to be done, and so you need a set of screwdrivers. One screwdriver just won't do it.
Very good. Okay, we are running out of time. I think we've got time for just a couple more. Let me see if I can find the one I was looking at. Dave Carlson asks, he says, will FIRA be an annual requirement? In other words, you do it, the first one, end of next December, and will there be annual updates thereafter?
Wow, loaded question. So that is, I will speak to it from a Thyra process standpoint. I believe what the person is actually asking about is from a grant standpoint.
Yes.
And the short answer is, I don't have that answer. And I don't know that any of us have that answer yet. From a process standpoint, you know, as, again, I don't even know that I can claim being a former state guy. It's been 8 years. I don't know if I'm allowed to play that card anymore. I would personally revisit my results every year, not necessarily redo. But I would revisit every year and see if something has happened in that last year that would cause me to change my answers. Maybe, you know, we've always said we've been worried about this size event, and come to find out we've had two events in the last year that were bigger than that. Or, you know, maybe a new threat has emerged that causes me great concern that was not previously accounted for. So from a pure process standpoint, and not speaking to the grant programs or other requirements that might be out there, I would encourage everybody to revisit their results on an annual basis and assess whether they need to be updated or not.
I'm going to kind of condense one last question. I understand there is a memo. We have linked to a memo that has to do with the grant guidance, and I gather the grantees are going to be submitting them to the FEMA regions?
That's correct.
Okay. And will you be providing training and or publishing the guidance that you will provide to the FEMA regions for evaluating the virus?
The FEMA regions will be using 201.
Okay.
To see, and what they're looking at is how the process was used. You know, we don't want to get in this position where we are caught up in some bizarre circle back and forth, or flow back and forth for jurisdictions. The, you know, ideal situation is that we're all participating in this process as it moves forward, and the DAIT regions serve as an excellent source of data and information and support. When it comes time for that submittal, that focus is on consistency with the process in 201, which I believe is outlined in the bulletin that was issued with 201 to provide some high points of what would be looked at when those fibers were submitted by the states. So take a look to that. But 201 is much like in the past when we've done reviews on planning, you know, we reviewed using the guide. So 101 was the source when we did when we reviewed plans. Obviously, we'd go to 201 when reviewing the fibers.
All right. I think it's time to wrap it up for today. We're losing a few folks and some of our audio, but I think we managed to get through it pretty much completely. Doc, once again, on behalf of Ava Jean and myself and, of course, and all our participants today, thank you very much for joining us and making that time to share this information with us. We really appreciate it.
Great. Now, thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you. And, folks, before you go, you can use this feedback form to submit additional comments. And I do a couple more announcements. We are very pleased to announce a new EIIP partner today, all the way from Australia. That is the First 24 Hours Foundation, represented by its founder, Eddie Andrews. And please do look them up on our partners list, which is linked from our homepage. And they have some very nice public education resources there that you might benefit from. And if your organization is interested in partnering with the EIP, please do see the link from our homepage, or, of course, it's linked in all our announcements. Now, again, if you're not on a mailing list, you can just go to our homepage to subscribe, and then you will get a notice that when the recording and the slides are available late this afternoon. And then, again, we will have a transcript most likely a Monday of next week. We want to thank everyone who joined us today for participating, and we hope you got some benefit out of it, and we do appreciate your questions. Sorry we couldn't get to all of them. But, again, we'll put that corrected email address in the slides when they're ready to be posted, and you can grab that and follow up as needed. Have a great afternoon, everyone. We are adjourned. Thank you.